And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. A delegation builds legal legislative support for Central American migrants and TPS holders with Iván Espinosa Madrigal, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice, who is also driving the landmark Centro Presente versus Trump lawsuit challenging the termination of TPS. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
So let's begin with the premise for the need for what you were trying to accomplish with the delegation you went to with, which was a high-profile delegation of federal and local elected officials and immigration advocates and legal experts who traveled to Honduras and El Salvador.
The need for this delegation is really multifaceted. I think there is significant misinformation out there about the conditions in these countries and why people are migrating from these countries to the United States, and ultimately whether immigrants from those countries can be sent back to Honduras and El Salvador safely. The government claims that people can be sent back in large numbers, and that is the premise of terminating critically important humanitarian programs like temporary protected status for nationals of those countries. And so going to Central America to visit countries affected by the cancellation of these humanitarian programs is important so that we could set the record straight and see with our own eyes what the conditions are. What are people living? What are people fleeing? And it's important for members of Congress, like Congressman McGovern, to see that as well, so that they can take that into account in policy making. So this was a very important trip to be able to really rebut myths about country conditions in Central America.
So if you could do that for us now, talk about the delegation's findings and raise awareness of the conditions driving the migration from the region.
I think in a nutshell, the most important takeaway is that migration to the United States has changed significantly over the last couple of decades. Yet most understandings of what is really triggering the immigrants to come to the United States hasn't changed. We still think about migrants and why they come here in a 1990s type of way as economic migrants, people who are just trying to be a part of the American dream. And that is not what's happening today. The bottom line is that people aren't coming here to be a part of the American dream. They are coming here because they're trying to escape the Honduras and the Salvadorian nightmare. It is deeply rooted in forced migration due to violence. And that is the driving force behind what we're seeing playing out at the border. This is why caravans are showing up at our southern border. This is why mothers with children are showing up at our border. What is triggering this migration is the violence, the instability. And by this violence and instability, I don't just mean gang violence. I also mean state violence, because it's almost a state of war. It's literally a state of war when in El Salvador and Honduras, the homicide rate is just as high as what you would experience in a war-ravaged country like Syria. You are just as likely to die in these Central American countries as you are to die from the civil war in Syria. And so we're talking about really dire conditions, and that's not a part of most American understandings of immigration.
When you say gang violence, and when you say state-sponsored violence, could you give a little bit more detail about that in both countries?
Yeah, of course. The bottom line is that with the surge in gang violence, most of the military and police interventions that have happened have been quite brutal in the scope and in the impact that is being felt on the ground. So for each gang-related activity that has been reported, for example, in San Salvador, we see a very, very strong state response. And that state response manifests itself often in killing indiscriminately gang members and bystanders in military and police interventions to quell gang activity. So there have been documented massacres that have taken place in low-income neighborhoods where there is a high incidence of gang activity. So police would come in to, quote-unquote, cleanse a neighborhood, cleanse the streets of gang activity, and in doing so, they just shoot up the place. And you are impacted by this type of violence and warlike conditions, regardless of whether you're a gang member, a gang affiliate, or a gang sympathizer. You could just be a random bystander who gets caught up in this wave, this very far-reaching net of violence. And so what we're seeing is not just gang members targeting civilians, for example, by extorting them and extorting businesses or trying to recruit teenagers to join the gang. Of course, that's happening on the ground, and that could be directly tied to private actors, to the gangs themselves. But we're then seeing the other side of the coin as well, which is the state apparatus using police and military to sweep the ground, and in so doing is really targeting not just the gang members, but people living in low-income communities where this gang activity tends to happen. And so there are documented massacres that have been taking place with no police accountability. And often these type of raids in these communities are being conducted with U.S. military and tactical training and support.
If we could get into that last part of what you suggested, to give us a better idea whether we're talking about, and if we're talking both about Honduras and whether we're talking about Honduras and El Salvador in that instance. What is provoking those gangs, and should we be creating that kind of bifurcation of violence versus economic deprivation, which is certainly related to the political structure and system, and in my belief, should be a well-founded basis for people to immigrate here, too, when they're facing abject poverty, destitution, starvation. So can you parse that out for us a little bit more, the role of the U.S. and the intersectionality, really, of poverty in these countries and the growth of crime and violence?
You are absolutely right that there are families facing extreme poverty. We're talking about 56% of Honduras, for example, living with less than $1 a day. And nearly 80% of Honduras living in poverty. In El Salvador, the rates are a little better. They are not as economically deprived, but the numbers are still abysmal and quite frightening. And I think in this manner, and also in the gang-related activities, we see tremendous similarity between what happens in Honduras and what happens in El Salvador. The two countries are closely intertwined in these aspects, both in the depth of economic deprivation that is being felt on the ground, but also by similar patterns of gang activity, extreme militarization in response to that gang activity, and also tremendous corruption and impunity, so that no one can be really held accountable. The institutions that we often take for granted in the United States, being able to go and file a police report, knowing that if you go to the police, you're not going to suffer repercussions for that. No one is going to come to your house and harm you because you want to report them. The police certainly won't take action against you in that way. And that once your complaint is filed, that it will be investigated. And that investigation will even involve potentially an independent prosecutor who will be in charge of addressing that. And you will be assigned a public defender. All of those legal mechanisms that in the United States we have in place, what I will call legal infrastructure, legal institutions, simply don't exist down there. There are no witness protection programs. People don't trust the police. People don't trust the government. And certainly, the government isn't generating either the security, the institutions, or the economic opportunities for its citizens. There are more people coming into the labor market every year in Honduras and El Salvador than the government can possibly, that the economy can possibly absorb in terms of jobs. So you're right that these issues of poverty are intertwined with a lot of the violence that we're seeing. But it's also important to note that under American and international law, the most important thing is whether you're fleeing violence as opposed to fleeing poverty. And that's an important distinction. If you show up at the border and you say that you're fleeing poverty, you do not have the same legal protections under asylum or refugee law than you would if you say, I am fleeing gang violence, or the police came into my community to cleanse it and it killed my relatives. And because I lived in that neighborhood, they are associating me with a gang, even though I'm not a gang member. And so now they're after me. Those cases are dealt in a different way under our asylum and refugee laws. And so you are right that there are intertwined aspects, but legally they are not dealt with in that intertwined manner. But one thing that is for sure is that the same dynamics that we see on the ground in Honduras are replicated in El Salvador and vice versa. And that's why in most understandings of this region, they call Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras the Northern Triangle of Central America, because they really do move forward together in these really tremendous deprivations of both economic opportunity and security.
So what I want to do now then, and we're speaking with Yvonne Espinosa Madrigal, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice. And as I said before, when we opened up, you are involved in what is a landmark case, Centro Presente versus Trump, the lawsuit challenging the termination of TPS status. So let me ask you this. How do your findings connect to buttressing the demand not to cancel the TPS status and keeping those refugees of violence, those migrants who have come here to save their lives virtually? How do your findings inform that litigation and the continuation of temporary protective status for people from Central America?
At the Lawyers Committee, we filed the first lawsuit at the national level, focusing on the cancellation of temporary protected status, TPS, for Honduras and El Salvador. There are hundreds of thousands of immigrants who have lived in the United States for well over two decades who are participating in these life-saving humanitarian programs. The programs have existed, like I said, for over two decades. They've existed under both Democratic and Republican administrations. So this isn't a blue or a red, a D or an R issue. These programs have been in place for a long time. And under the Trump administration, the programs are being dismantled. The Trump administration says that these programs are no longer needed, that these countries are not facing any type of humanitarian crisis, and that therefore they are capable of absorbing hundreds of thousands of people who would be sent back to this region. In our lawsuit, we are asking the federal court to invalidate the Trump administration's decision. We're basically asking the court to reverse the cancellation of the programs and to reinstate them. And a big part of what we're saying is not just that the Trump administration is biased against these immigrants. If you can recall, the Trump administration referred to immigrants from these countries as people coming from an expletive type of country. And those type of remarks really show the purpose and intent behind canceling the programs. These are undesirable immigrants. The Trump administration would rather have Norwegians here than have immigrants from these countries. And so we're making that argument in court. But also connected to that argument is that these countries simply cannot absorb these immigrants, and that our clients will be returned to countries that are not functioning, that cannot provide them with jobs or security, countries where they will be essentially facing a death sentence.
And in addition to that, how is the U.S. making it much harder for new refugees to get into this country, this zero-tolerance policy, and also the separation of children from families?
One of the things that we were able to do when we were in Central America is to meet with families affected by this separation crisis at the borders. We were able to meet with two families. One family hasn't seen their six-year-old boy for 3 months. That little boy has been held in a facility in Cayuga, New York, for 3 months, separated from his mother and father, who were deported immediately after coming into the country without their son. The six-year-old boy is desperate to be reunited with his family, and so is the family when we spoke to them in Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras. They are willing, ready, and able to take responsibility over their child. They thought that they were going to be reunited with the boy when they were being deported. That's what the government promised them. But that did not happen, and there is no date certain for their return. There is no agreement from the government that the kid will be returned. There is nothing, no word from the U.S. government, no word from the Honduran government. What we're talking about here is not just a crisis that happened and is over. There are 500 children approximately who are similarly situated, who remain in our detention facilities in the United States, but whose parents are no longer on U.S. soil because we have effectuated their removal. We need to reunify these kids with their families, and that is an urgent, urgent need. We also had an opportunity to speak to families who are talking about how the U.S. is providing military support and aid to train police officers, but doesn't hold those governments to U.S. standards to respect the rights of people. So we train them and we release them into the field, but there's no accountability about how they approach their jobs. And that lack of accountability, which leads to a lot of police brutality, leads to the massacres I discussed earlier, that is also connected to the United States and our policies. So it's not just what we're doing domestically by separating these families. It's also what we're doing internationally by providing tactical support and training, but not following up with the countries to make sure that there's accountability and that there is legal infrastructure and institutions to support these people.
And we're speaking again with Yvonne Espinosa Madrigal, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice. And one of the things that I'm interested in is the relief that you seek in the lawsuit that you have brought around TPS. And we are talking about people who have TPS status, and that is from Central America, primarily 250,000 people. And then, of course, there are Haitians who are similarly seeking and fighting against the expiration of TPS status, their TPS status. So the particular relief that you seek at this point, and I should say, I know that's on the legal level, but if there are also ideas that you have about legislative enactment towards the support of migrants, refugees who have been forced out of their countries by virtue of violence, by virtue of economic deprivation, and so on, very often from the policies that the U.S. supports of reactionary government structure.
Absolutely. To start with our lawsuit against the federal government to reinstate the temporary protected status program for Central American countries and Haiti, in that lawsuit, that's exactly what we're asking for. We're not asking for anything other than the continuation of a program that has existed for a long time. I think the federal government is really caught up on this idea that temporary protected status was supposed to be temporary. Well, the operative word was never temporary. It was protected. It is to keep people from being killed, keep people from being returned to countries that cannot readily provide for their safety and well-being. And we've lost touch of that. We've lost touch of the fact that these are humanitarian programs that are aligned with our American values. And that is really important. So in our case, we're asking for TPS to be reinstated. Give these people an opportunity to remain here until a correct and accurate account of what's happening in the home countries can be conducted and a plan really put into place. And like you're saying, there are policy dimensions here as well, because we deeply believe that you need to deploy multiple methodologies to secure the rights of vulnerable people and marginalized communities. And through multiple methodologies, I'm talking about not just our lawsuit to reinstate TPS, I'm also talking about legislation and policy. And that's where our congressional delegation to TPS countries in Central America really comes into play. We need legislation that will secure the rights of not just TPS recipients, but other people like the DACA dreamers, the children of immigrants who have been American for all intents and purposes, except that they were born in a different place and brought here when they were very young. So we need those proposals as well. And we would be really looking forward to seeing those proposals advance. I think ultimately, what we also need is to have a very sensible plan for how we move forward with immigration in this country. And I know that's a controversial issue, but we have to be able to compromise. We have to be able to get all of these factors aligned. What we want to do to maintain a steady flow of workers, not just for farms, but for factories and for high-level tech companies. We also need to be able to navigate the humanitarian responsibilities we have as a world leader. And We need to make sure that people who are already here, who do not pose a criminal or public safety threat, can be meaningfully incorporated into our society. All of these things need to happen. And so comprehensive immigration reform is long overdue, and we need to come up with a sensible plan that works for Democrats and Republicans, a bipartisan plan, and something that is a compromise. You know, neither side is going to get everything that they want, but that creates a sensible plan to move forward in a responsible manner.
And we're going to spend time, certainly in the weeks and months to come, to bring people like yourself back to discuss exactly what those recommendations would be and the various strategies for trumping the Trump administration's absolute reactionary responses to those people who have been the builders, the movers, the shakers, the heart, the soul of this country. And that is certainly the African labor that was brought here, the indigenous people, and the rest of the people. Who are they? They are the immigrants. This is a nation of immigrants, and it has benefited economically, politically, socially, and most decidedly culturally from the diversity of the people here who created the wealth of this country. We want to thank you so much for that report. Again, we have been speaking with Yvonne Espinosa Madrigal, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice. And you can go to their website and find out more about the landmark suit, Centro Presente versus Trump. And we'll continue to keep you posted as that suit winds its way for the courts. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.